建设。
If I can just have everyone's attention. On behalf of my family.
We're going to bring in some more chairs.
For those of you standing, we will be bringing in more chairs. On behalf of my family, I'd like to thank you, first of all for coming to the Ruth Kalman Memorial Lecture, our fourth year in honor of memory of my mother, Aleha Shalom. We've had some wonderful speakers in the past, and we'll continue, as you'll see very soon, in that tradition. This week's Parsha, Parshat Balocha, begins with a description of the menorah, of the candelabra that we had every single day lit in the Beit HaMikdash, in the temple. The parsha begins by describing the method of lighting the menorah. And the Torah tells us that Daber la'aron v'amartai lav v'halotcha ha'neirot and will stand ha'mnara ya'iru shivat ha'neirot. The Torah tells us that, first of all, that the mitzvah, the commandment is to Aaron, that these lights, the seven lights of the menorah, have to be lit every single day. And there's an emphasis on the idea of the halotcha, when you light the menorah. And Rashi points out in a very famous statement, Rashi tells us, Hashem shalah of Ola, the idea that the flame rises up, that you have to make sure when you light the menorah that the actual flame takes on its own life, is able to stand by itself. And I think this idea is really appropriate when talking about parents, and especially my mother, that while each of us, speaking on behalf of my brother, my sister, when we think about our mother, we miss her dearly every single day, and yet she gave us the tools that, for us at least, we can go on. She gave us the chinuch, the education, that we can go be ole me'aleha. She made sure to be with us, to teach us in actions and deeds and words every single day, to give us a foundation in which we can carry on in our life, even though it's never the same. No matter how old you are, when you lose a parent, you'll always be your mother's child, and we feel like that all the time. But we also, as we stand here today, we thank her deeply for giving us those tools that we can go on in life, and constantly remindful of the messages that she taught to us every single day. The parsha continues in describing the actual building of the menorah. It tells us that it has to be misham. It has to be from one block. As Rashi points out, it can't be me'evarim, evarim. It's not, when the menorah was fashioned, it wasn't fashioned from various types of blocks of various pieces. It was actually one mold. And talking about the speaker, I think that's very appropriate. Not only is Rabbi Terigan a very solid person, and I can tell you that from knowing him for almost 20 years, going back to our years together in Gush Etzion, learning together, knowing him as a very solid football player and other types of sporting abilities, which we won't get into right now. But really, Rabbi Terigan is an incredibly solid person in every sense of the word. As I mentioned, I've had the pleasure of knowing him for a long time. We've been very close friends over that time, and he's really, I think, one of the people that I always have looked up to in all levels of his life, in both his learning, his incredible hasmada. Rabbi Terigan was always among the last people in the Beis Medrash every night, and he still is like that. Tremendous hasmada, even though he has six kids. That Magdi Akhavush from Mazel Tov, he just celebrated the Bat Mitzvah, his daughter, 3 weeks ago. So Mazel Tov on that. And it's very appropriate that we have been speaking in memory of my mother, the fact that we know each other, and special for me at least, that somebody that I know is speaking in her honor, but again, he represents all of the good things that my mother really lived for and went about, the tremendous passion that she had for learning in all senses, for herself, for her children, for everybody. And Rabbi Kerrigan, as I mentioned, is really a great role model. We have many of his talmidim, many of his students here. He's known as really one of the top stars in Israel in the yeshivot. People look up to him, they flock to him, to hear him, both in Gush Etzion, in Yeshivat Har Etzion, and in the lectures that he gives throughout Israel. He really is a beacon for many of the young students that come there and come to be transformed during their year or 2 years or even longer in Israel. So it gives me tremendous pleasure and pride really to have him as a friend, for him to be here, and to really learn from him, as we will, I'm sure, over this next hour. Thank you. I just wanted to mention to you, this is a technical matter, there are two sheets that Rabbi Kerrigan has prepared, so make sure you have two sheets, and also anybody who's not signed in on Rabbi Kalman, my brother's email list, there are sheets at the table. If you've not signed in, please make sure to sign in.
Thank you. Wednesday evening, last night, I sat at my kitchen table with my children, listening to their complaints. Abba, you have to travel again. Fortunately or unfortunately, I find myself traveling more often than I'd like on behalf of the yeshiva. And my 11-year-old looked at me and said, Abba, can't you stay home? So I explained to them that one of the most special people in my life was about to celebrate a simcha that I wouldn't miss for the world. As you know, something that the person who introduced me didn't mention, this is a very special, meaningful weekend for Mishpachas Kelman, for the Kelman family. Of course, this is a share dedicated to their mother, Alea Shalom, wife. But it's also Monday evening, Amir Tashem Lechasana, Avraham Mori Kelman, who has been one of my special influences, one of my special lights and beacons over the last 20 years. And I said that so much of our experiences as his friends over the years have been the subject of so much joy and sharing on his behalf that I wouldn't miss his chasana for the world. There's nothing that could keep me away. So Baruch Hashem, it was a trip well worth taking, hopefully a lesson to my daughter, well worth learning. And I just want to thank the Kelman family for inviting me to be part of both ends of this meaningful weekend. And they really aren't brackets, they really are one unified moment. I think that the greatest testament, the greatest light, and the greatest reflection of everything that Ruth Alea Shalom stood for will clearly be seen in Mirz Hashem Monday evening. Mirz Hashem, Abba Aleinu L'Tova. So I want to thank you for that somewhat inflated introduction, but more importantly for being part of your simcha and being part of your family. The past couple of years, we've witnessed a very troubling and in many ways dangerous phenomenon. An unholy alliance between terror and religion. Between fundamentalism, strict, inflexible adherence to fundamentals, and fanaticism. Between devotion, piety, religious commitment, and destruction, carnage, and death. In North America, of course, this came to a head about 2 years ago, on September 11th. In Eretz Yisrael, we've been facing this for close to a decade. Of course, the last couple years of the Intifada has witnessed an intensification of sorts. As Westerners, we instinctively are repulsed by fundamentalist terror, by Islamic fundamentalism, and certainly the manifestations that we are all victim of. But if we assess this movement a little bit more carefully, noticing its subtleties, not just its broad strokes, we find that there are many aspects and many components of these movements which are quite similar, which we quite identify with, as of the Hashem, the Shabbat Torah mitzvahs. If, for example, we assess the laws of modesty, in particular the way that we dress and the attention we place on dress, we find ourselves in some instances much closer to these cultures than to the encircling Christian culture. If we inspect family values, the role, the function, the centrality of family within building a society, certainly these cultures place an emphasis on family life, which is highly reminiscent of our own emphasis. If we consider chesed, not chesed merely in the institutional sense, in that respect we have a lot to be proud of, organizations, institutions, but chesed in the interpersonal sense, person to person, heart to heart, human being to human being, that type of chesed is clearly one of the hallmarks of Islamic society, and in particular, of Islamic fundamentalist society. Need I remind you that Hamas, a great enemy of ours, had its roots as a charity organization, pretty much as a gemach, handing out to the needy, supporting the destitute. But if there's one area in which the parity, the equivalence between our own lives, our own religious consciousness, and Islamic fundamentalism is glaring, it's in the very definition of fundamentalism and in the willingness to sacrifice everything, even our lives, on behalf of that belief. Who must not acknowledge, who will not concede, that in the end of the day, we're all fundamentalists? If fundamentalism is defined as a strict, unwavering adherence to fundamental principles of life, of ethics, of morality, which were laid down thousands of years ago through a divine delivery, which are impregnable to the passages of time, which are not altered by the changes and sweeps of history, if that is how we define fundamentalists, then we are all fundamentalists. And we dare not define ourselves as anything less. Sometimes our language can be a bit confusing. We have to be careful about the semantics we employ and the vernacular we use to describe our world, and in particular to describe ourselves. For example, sometimes we refer to certain sections of the Orthodox community as ultra-Orthodox. Does any of us have any right or privilege to be anything less? Can a Jew aspire to be anything less than ultra-Orthodox, anything less than perfect? Perhaps other terms are more appropriate, terms which reflect socio-demographic differences rather than religious gradations. But not only are we fundamentalists, we are fundamentalists, and one of the central tenets of our creed, of our heritage, of our religious journey, is the willingness, the pride, to sacrifice our lives on behalf of our God, on behalf of our love for our God, when called to. Who in this room isn't the product of Mesiras Nefesh al Kiddush Hashem? Who in this room doesn't have a relative, isn't aware of a story of a Jew who was faced with the dilemma, with the challenge, his love for God and his life, and proudly and triumphantly offered his life to glorify and to sanctify Kodesh Baruch Hu? How different is this really from a suicide bomber, Yimach Shemo, who also believes that he's sacrificing his life or her life on behalf of their God? What are the differences between the hallowed principle of the Ahavtas Hashem Elokecha b'chol levavcha b'chol nafshecha b'chol miyodecha? You should love your God with your soul, with your heart, even if he takes your life. And these cruel, bestial suicide bombers who are guilty of such carnage. That, I believe, is a very pressing question. And it's a question which, of course, is too complicated to encapsulate, to solve completely in the span of an hour, or under an hour. But allow me this evening to present a few guidelines, a few differences, some of the more glaring differences which define our religion at its root, are part and parcel of religious consciousness, and serve to discriminate between these vulgar, repulsive behaviors and our own religious pursuit. The first difference speaks to the manner in which man envisions his God. What is our image of Hashem? What is our vision? What is our definition of God? Well, the Torah tells us, source number one, a pasuk in Vayikra, Ushmartem eschukosai yes mishpatai, should heed my laws, page number one, Asher yase osam ha'adam v'chai bohem, ani Hashem. Torah, Judaism, is a life-embracing religion. It's not meant to suppress or to stifle human experience, but to ennoble it, to inspire it, to redeem it, to uplift it. B'chai b'ren, religion is not meant to cause death. It's meant to celebrate life, to champion life, and to embrace it. God is not a blood-loving God. He doesn't lust after revenge. He doesn't desire human sacrifice. He doesn't covet murder. He covets life and peace and prosperity. It advances the human condition rather than retards it. The very famous Rambam, which is built on this pasuk, to me is one of the Rambams, one of the few Rambams which a person should study and sort of emblazon on his consciousness. The Rambam, source number three, the Chasham is current day, Salach HaGimel, describes the laws of someone who is deathly ill on Shabbos. In an instance of Bikuach Nefesh, where someone's life hangs in the balance, so Bikuach Nefesh is Delcha Shabbos. We violate Shabbos to drive the ambulance, to provide medical care, or anything else that's necessary to alleviate the medical condition, even if it desecrates the Shabbos. The Rambam writes, source number three, Kisha Osin Divarim Ha'ilu, when we desecrate the Shabbos, Ein Osir Osam Lari Be'Nachim V'Lari Be'Tanim V'Lari De'Avadim V'Lari De'Nashim. Don't assume that inasmuch as we're violating Shabbos, let's delegate this violation to inferior members of our environment. Let's ask the children to violate Shabbos. Let's ask the servants. In the Rambam's historical context, as you know, women were seen as inferior. No chauvinism here. The Rambam's writing in his own context. Let the women be Machal Shabbos. But that we should be Machal Shabbos, let's delegate these tasks to other people. So, line number two, the end of the line. Source number three. Elai de Gidoli Yisrael Chachmeir. The rabbi should be driving the ambulance. The Rosh Yeshiva, the tzaddik, the gadol should be the one issuing the medical care. The Achor Nismameh Bechilul Shabbos. You cannot waver, you cannot tarry, you cannot delay. Well, maybe we'll hold out, and the situation will be alleviated on its own. Shenemar, line number four. Asher Yatsa Olso Ha'adam Lachai Vayem, Velo Shayamus Vayem. The purpose, the objective of religion is life and not death. And here, of course, the Rambam editorializes. Listen to this line carefully, the end of line four. Ha lamadita she'ein mishtikei ha'tara nekama ba'olam. The Torah's promise is not revenge and death. Ela rachamim v'chesed v'shalom. Purpose of the Torah, the purpose of Rachmana, is rachamim, chayim v'shalom, harmony, mercy, compassion. And now the Rambam has harsh words for people who distort this message. The elu apikorsim, an apikors, sha'omim shezechil Shabbos, who will explain and maintain that this is indeed chilul Shabbos and medical treatment should be delivered. The author, Alein HaKosher Vomer, about them the Torah writes, and the Rambam here refers to Yecheskel, Perakot, some of you might want to scan that in source number 2. Alein HaKosher Vomer, Gam Ani Nasati Lam Chukim Lo Tovim, U'Mishpatim Lo Yechiv Bahem. They perverted a Torah which is supposed to be Mahayim into Chukim Lo Tovim, U'Mishpatim Lo Yechiv Bahem. HaKadosh Baruch Hu delivers this code, this system, to enhance, to redeem, to lend us more dignity. He is a lover of life, not a pursuer or coveter of death. This is the first distortion of religion which has been committed. That God is happy? Remember the hands in Ramallah? The blood-stained hands raised in a sign of victory? As if God celebrates human death, that's the show. When human beings suffer, they are creatures of HaKadosh Baruch Hu, and they are deserving of our compassion and our pity, our attendance and our assistance, because they possess Tzelem Elokim. Whether they are colleagues, and part of our nation, or brothers, or even our enemies. When homeless people in Iraq suffer, our hearts should be torn. Not necessarily as deeply as it's torn when Jews suffer. When innocent Palestinians, I'm not talking about people who are directly involved in terror, but innocent Palestinians who despise us, who have been trained to see us as their enemy, but when they suffer, I'm not necessarily suggesting this should dictate our policy, our political or military policy, but at a human level, is HaKadosh Baruch Hu happy? Is there a victory dance in Shemayim? Master Yadai Tovim Bayam, Bethemo and Shira. The Egyptians, our tormentors for hundreds of years, were drowned in the Red Sea. You dare say Shira? HaKadosh Baruch Hu does not covet blood. HaKadosh Baruch Hu does not desire human sacrifice. These are not part of religion. These are invasive of religion. HaKadosh Baruch Hu dragged Avraham Avinu up to Har Moria, brought him to the brink of human sacrifice. The knife was drawn, the blade was glistening in the sun. Al tishlach yadcha el hanar, v'al tas lo meruma. He brought Avraham Avinu to the brink of human sacrifice, only to illustrate, al tas lo meruma. I don't desire korbanos of human life. Rashi points out, source number 5, Al Tishlach, page number 2, Lishchot. Don't sacrifice Yitzchak. Amar Lo. So Avraham complained. L'china b'asilakan. Rav Shalom, so much courage, so much fervor, so much conviction, so much defiance these last 3 days to bring my son here. How could you know the turmoil in my heart? And I've overcome it. If I can't shecht him, Esther Al-Khabala, top line, at least let me slice his neck, at least let me draw a little bit of blood, at least let me do something to express my passion, my intensity, my faith. Amar lei al tas lo meuma, al tas lo meuma. I don't want death, I don't desire blood, I don't want Yitzchak to be injured, he is to return unscathed. Avraham Avinu's great message to mankind was the twinning between religion and life. It is not incidental that Avraham was both the Yish HaChesed, Tikkun Emes LeYaakov, the Chesed LeAvraham, as well as the great philosopher who discovered HaKadosh Baruch Hu, the father of monotheism, Hestakel Bevira, the Hebrew Hezbara. Avraham performed these two functions, but not as separate tasks, as one integrated message. That religion is meant to improve the human condition, to alleviate human suffering, to advance the standard of living. If he is to be the greatest philosopher, he must also be the champion of chesed. Man at that point had already discovered that religion can lead to a higher state of human perfection. There was a man, there was a city, there was a community who finally deciphered the message that religion is meant to complete, to perfect, to refine the human soul. That man's name was Melchizedek. And the place in the city he inhabited was Shalem. Melchizedek was a Kohen, a priest, a religious clergyman. And he lived in the city of Shalem, the city which was called because it would produce or facilitate human perfection, Shlemos. After consecutive failures, the Dor HaMabul, the Dor HaPlaga, after failing to improve the human lot, people turned back to religion, to the Kohen, in order to attain Shlemos. Melchizedek Melech Shalem. Avram, of course, added one component to the religious experience. True Shlemos cannot be reached solely on human terms, even if those human terms are inspired by a divine presence. True Shlemos can only emerge from an encounter with a transcendent God. Religion is a thrust beyond the human realm to a higher realm, an encounter, a rendezvous with a different being. And Abraham contributed the first part of that city's name. The city was already called Shalem. And Abraham added the prefix Yerah. The Shlemos is only a product of encounter, of Gilui Shchina, of man standing before God, clinging to God, obeying God, being inspired by God. Parshas Vayera begins with the first Gilui Shchina in history, Vayera Elav Hashem, Me'elon Emanuel, V'hu Yoshev Pesach Ha'ol Tichom Hayom. Why did Hashem come to Abraham that morning? There were plenty of malachim to perform different tasks, to heal Sarah, to inform Sarah, to save Lot. Why did Hashem's Bible come to Abraham that morning? He came to inaugurate the process of Gilui Shchina. Until that point, HaKadosh Baruch Hu had commanded man, had punished man, had signed treaties with man and taken oaths to man, but had yet to appear to man. And Abraham was the first person to reach the state of Tzimimus, his Halach Lefarai Ve'yei Tamim, which is a higher state than Shlemos. He was a Tamim. And he now was capable of encountering the Shchina. Vayera Elav Hashem Elo Neimarei. V'hu Yoshev Pesach Ha'ol Tichom Hayom. HaKadosh Baruch Hu appears to him. Parshas Vayera begins with Gilui Shchina, with Yeraya, Vayera Elav Hashem, and it concludes with Gilui Shchina. The Har Hashem, Yeraya. The only difference, of course, is that in the beginning of the parasha, God comes to man. In the end of the parasha, man has to find God. Man has to seek God. Hashem doesn't tell Abraham which mountain to sacrifice Yitzchak. Na'alei Hashem li'olah al-achad yarim asher amari lecha. This is the great message of monotheism. This is the great message of our heritage. This is the great message of the Judeo-Christian tradition. That religion is not the enemy of life, but its greatest supporter, its greatest grace. That religion is meant to redeem the human experience by allowing a thrust into a transcendent realm. By and large, our world is divided more or less into two cultures. Those cultures that are built upon the monotheistic tradition of Judaism, of Christianity, by and large, enjoy a high standard of living, medical coverage, economic stability, political freedom. By and large, those cultures which are still mired in the paganistic world of old, by and large, those cultures do not enjoy these same pleasures, do not enjoy these same standards, are still stricken with poverty, with political persecution, with inept medical coverage, with fragile societies. The great message of Avraham Avinu was illustrated at the top of our memoria. Al tishlach yachel anar, the al taslo me'uma. Do not injure the child. Do not sacrifice him. Do not draw his blood. Ei mishtepe ha'tara nekama ba'olam. As the Rambam writes, the laws of the Torah are not vengeful and bloodless. El rachamim v'chayim v'shalom. This is, of course, the first difference. What happens to a culture that views its God as wrathful, as angry, as a God who seeks retribution, as opposed to what happens to a culture which views its God as peaceful and just, merciful? In the name, of course, of Bernard Lewis, what went wrong? What many of you must have seen. How did the Islamic culture go from the superior position it maintained throughout much of the medieval era to the clearly inferior position which it possesses in today's world, the cause of so much Muslim rage? What led to the Renaissance, to the Industrial Revolution, to the achievement of democracy? What stirred these movements in Western civilization? In part because we viewed our God as just and a lover of life and a desire of peace. And if our world wasn't perfect, well, it became our religious mission to perfect it. If humans suffered, if we're a victim to the forces of nature, if we're a victim to the abuses of man, then it became not just our human charge, but our religious destiny to improve, to discover, to inquire, to advance technology, medicine, science, political freedom, the unfurling of the human spirit is very much part of the religious quest to discover God and to perfect the world which he endowed us with. What happens to a culture which views its God as wrathful and vengeful? Is there any more motivation to perfect that world? Is there any desire to change its terms, to perfect its flaws? If God himself does not desire life and prosperity, why should man act as his proxy? English that they are power in the come about them, El Rachamim, V'chayim, V'chesed. The second difference between the hallowed image of Mesiras Nefesh, Al-Kiddush Hashem, and a suicide bomber, Yimach Shemo, is the motive. Not just the image of Hashem, the image of God, but the motive. What is the motive which drives a suicide bomber? When these bombers are interviewed prior to their dastardly missions, what do they feel awaits them in heaven at the end of this mission? We've all heard it. We've all cringed. The 72 virgins. A human being who sacrifices his life for 72 virgins, whose name is he sanctifying? Whose purpose is he serving? Whose goal is he sacrificing for? His God? For his own lust, his own carnal desires, that which is base and vile within him. Throughout our history, not one single Jew went to the stake or to the gas chamber solely to merit that ticket to the next world. But because of the pasuk I mentioned before, the Atas Hashem Elokecha, b'chol levavecha, b'chol nafshecha, b'chol miyodecha, the love we feel for this invisible, mysterious being is so deep, is so passionate, that it forced you or even willing to die for it, rather than allow its clarity to be compromised. There is an astounding Gemara in Sakhin, which for years perplexed me. But Hashem, just recently I think I understand. It's verse number 6. Tashma, Sakhin Mun Gimel. Oh, Tzim Darash, Tudus Israel. Tudus from Rome provided the following question. Mara Uchanania Mishael Vazaria. This through Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah facing the greatest calling, the most challenging moment the Jew can experience, defy Nebuchadnezzar and be thrown into the Kibshan Aish, into the fiery furnace, or renege on your faith, on your conviction, on your religion. What inspired them? What moved Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah to such courage? If Chas V'Shalom, many of us were put into that situation, who would we draw inspiration from? Which images would we conjure up? Which great heroic Jewish lives would move us? Abraham, Yosef HaTzadik, perhaps Moshe Rabbeinu? Who did Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah think of at that moment? The Gemara says, source number 6, verse 2, Nasu kal v'chomer b'yatzma mitzvardin. They thought about the frogs. Here they were, this epic climactic moment, thinking about reptiles. What did they think about? Umat tzvardim. The frogs have no commandment to love God, and yet about them is written, Uvaru v'alu v'vesecha, uvitan recha, v'mishar asecha, and Mitzrayim, when HaKadosh Baruch Hu called them to battle, they eagerly flung themselves into Pharaoh's furnaces, into his ovens, to create greater havoc. Emachai Mishares Mitzirah, they sold Tavor, and they owned Mishar Shatan Archan, the ovens were hot. If the frogs were also Nefesh HaKadoshas Hashem, Aruch Shem Tzuvin, we have a command, Allah has come and come. God did Himmel. The frogs? Of all the creatures to draw inspiration from? All the heroic Jewish lives spent glorifying HaKadosh Baruch Hu's name? Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah needed a Musar Shmuz in the frogs? The answer, I believe, is as follows. Because a Jew does not sacrifice his life for schar, for Olam Haba. He sacrifices it to sanctify, to glorify, Mesakein Olam Emalach Meshakei. We're put onto this earth to sanctify, to serve, to create greater awareness of HaKadosh Baruch Hu. And we serve that purpose with every breath that we're given. When that breath is taken from us, we continue to glorify. And this message, Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah, could only draw from a creature which does not have an afterlife. There is no Olam Haba for frogs. There is no great pond in the sky to which the virtuous frogs alight to enjoy an eternal feast of flies. Frogs are mortal. They have no more immortality. And from the frog's example, Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah derived the notion that a Jew sacrifices his life for his God, not for his own purposes, not for his own afterlife, not chas v'shalom for his own rewards. There's a famous story which took place at the Umschlagplatz near the ghetto of Kovno. The Jews were gathered, were assembled one morning for that great euphemism called an action. You know, an action when Jews were trotted out by the thousands and tens of thousands to be slaughtered in the forest. And as the Jews were gathering at the Umschlagplatz, an halakhic question arose. What bracha is recited when performing the mitzvah of Kiddush Hashem? Kiddush Hashem, of course, is a mitzvah which a person only performs once in his life, if at all. And after a person performs that mitzvah, he no longer is around to deliver the tradition powers. So there is no clear-cut tradition which bracha to recite on Kiddush Hashem. And they were scurrying around trying to ask someone who had some knowledge, some tradition. Finally, they found the grandson of Rav Chanan Wasserman, who had some Masorah and the Chafetz Chaim, and what type of bracha to recite. To the casual observer, this scene is nothing less than pitiful. Pathetic. A few minutes left to live. Spend time with your family. Arrange your affairs. Enjoy the fall weather. What bracha to make, this way or that way? But to us, it is nothing less than triumphant. One more mitzvah. I've been taken from this world. As I'm taken, I'm serving at Kadosh Baruch Hu, sanctifying Hashem's name, demonstrating to others my deep-seated conviction and that God will never see me in an image I can never describe. How can I best serve Him with this last mitzvah? Final mitzvah. How can I best serve? Were they thinking about all of my father? Were they thinking about the great rewards which awaited them? Or were they thinking about the Nikdashi B'Soch B'nei Yisrael? The historical journey, the struggle to display HaKadosh Baruch Hu to a world audience, even when it elicits from them hatred, hostility, death, and persecution. The vision of the Eda Kopal Kiata Pialto, the Yavin Ko Yitzur Kiata Yitzur. One day, the entire chorus will proclaim Hashem will King Yisrael Melech, Umachusa Bakal Mashal. And this is the second difference. Not just in the way that we view God as wrathful, or as peaceful, as desirous of human sacrifice, or as compassionate and merciful. But how we define this act of dying on God's behalf? Make no mistake about it. There is a gulf of difference between a suicide bomber who serves his own petty, egotistical interests and the great tradition of the Mesiras Nefesh al Kiddush Hashem. The third difference, which to me is the most pivotal one, speaks not about the way in which we define our God, or the way in which we view this experience, but the way in which we view the relationship between our two worlds, Olam Hazeh and Olam Haba. A Jew lives in two worlds, in two domains, in two realms. Present, material, concrete realm, and the eternal future life of Olam Haba. How do we view the interaction between these two worlds? What is the dynamic between our experience in this world and what awaits us in the next world? Here too we look to Chazal for it. Source number 7. Relates to the episode in Parshas Vayera, where HaKadosh Baruch Hu demanded that Abraham send Ishmael, discard Ishmael. The process of selection is continuing. The chosen seed, the discarded seed. Kol asher tomar elach asara shema b'kola. My wife's favorite pasuk. Whenever Sarah tells you, listen to her. Good advice for marriage. Call Hashem Kamar Elecha Sarah Shema Bekola. Listen to Sarah. Ki bi Yitzchak Yikari Lecha Zarah. Because Yitzchak is your chosen seed. Yitzchak is your future. Yitzchak is your destiny. Of course, this pasuk carries one extra letter. The letter base. The Torah could have written Ki Yitzchak Yikari Lecha Zarah. Yitzchak will be called your seed. Why does the Torah, which doesn't waste words or letters or even crowns on the tops of letters, Why does the Torah write, why does Hashem tell Avram, ki big Yitzchak, base, big Yitzchak, yikar el Chazar? So Chazal wrote the extra days and of course interpreted as follows. I'm going to review that. Source number 7. Yitzchak ain't Sifkan. Doesn't say Yitzchak. Ella be Yitzchak. Reb Azariah b'shem Barachatia. So Reb Azariah amplified the Yidan statement. Beis. The letter Beis, which is spotlighted in this passage, is train, is two. The me, Medrash continues, second line, second word, source number 7, the me, Shemoda, the Shemites. The Beis signifies Yitzchak's uniqueness. Because Yitzchak acknowledges Beis alone. When I first read this Medrash, I interpreted it in a simple manner. Yitzchak is a vision of Olam Haba. Yitzchak is not shackled to this world, and therefore he is selected. I don't believe that's true textually, nor do I think it's true experientially, historically. Are we the only people? Are we the only religion with a vision of the afterlife? Are we the only culture which acknowledges Olam Haba? What Chazal are underlining is that Yitzchak's unique capacity is to acknowledge, to embrace, and ultimately to bridge two worlds at once. Our world is divided by and large into two very, very different cultures. Some cultures are so mired in the concrete reality of the day-to-day, the material world, the palpable presence, that they've completely abdicated a sense of the afterworld, of the next life, the secular city. And yet other cultures are so enchanted by the promises of an elusive afterlife, a utopian realm, that they flee from our own world, from its challenges, from its imperfections, from its mission. A Jew has the capacity to stand on top of both worlds. You cannot get to Olam Haba by murdering people in this world. That act reflects the way in which you view the two worlds. As separate, as detached. I can commit the most grievous crime, the most murderous behavior, and use that very behavior as my ticket to the next world. Such an attitude is unconscionable. To get to heaven, we have to take it there with us. The next world is an extension of our experiences, of our spiritual level, of our encounter with the Kodesh Baruch Hu in this world, without the hindrances, without the impediments, without the obstacles. But we don't seek reward. We seek results. We don't look for prizes. For us, Olam Haba is a natural consequence. It's a bridge. As the Rambam writes in Hilchos Teshuva, source number 8, Al Yomar Adam, Harini Osa Mitzvah Torah, the Osek Bechach Masa, a person should not say, I will perform the Torah's will, study its wisdom, Kidei Shaka, Belkon Abraham, Saksun Osva, to merit all the rewards and blessings. Oh, Kidei Shaka, Lachayu Olam Haba, but I'll get to the next world. Then one of the Ephrosh Bin Haveros, Shasira Talaman, I will abstain from sin. Kadesha and Nazel, I should be saved and rescued from the clouds and the curses. Tzuvas Matana. Oh, Kadesha Lord, Kadesh, Mechayel and Abba. I should be spared. I should not be cut off in the next world. Ey, Rari, Rabo, Esashem, Ramatan, Chazer. It's not the goal of the religious identity. Shehaovi, Ramatan, Chazer, person who serves God solely for reward out of fear of punishment. We're all waiting to hear him, squaking in a corner, shaking and trembling at God's wrath. The Ingram Malas Rabbinim, not the level of the prophet, the Malas Chachamim, nor the Chacham. They loved him, Hashem, all there is there. You know, he serves God this way. Again, excuse the anachronism. There's no shamanism intended. This is the Rambam's historical and social reality. You know, he serves God this way. On the Aretz, ignorant people. Now, Hashem, in those days, women, unfortunately, were ignorant, Baruch Hashem, today. They're no longer just the post on the Aretz. Stuck time, children. We train them to fear. Until they get a conscience, until they get a will, until they get an intellect, then they can start to love God. By the way, there's a very important statement in Islam about Chinuch. Chinuch has to start with you. But the Rambam writes, Ha'odei li'ava, source number, actually number 8, part 2, Halacha Deis. Ha'odei li'ava, Hosek the Torah of the Mitzvos, he serves like a Mishmarathu. The whole thing is Sibos HaChachma, he pursues knowledge and wisdom. Lo b'nei davar ba'olam, not for any ulterior purpose, it isn't the means. The lo b'nei yiras hara, not because he fears evil. The lo b'nei yiras hatova, not to inherit the good. And here's one of those phrases that I recommend you sort of retaining, memorizing. Ela otze ha'emes, mipnei shehu emes. He does what is right because it is right. V'self hatova lovo b'glava. And of course the good life will come as a product, will extend. Osa es ha'emes, out of a sense of deep-seated conviction that this is the highest and most noblest life, most noble lifestyle that a person can aspire towards. Sometimes I challenge the Talmidim and Yeshiva with the following question. What would happen if Hashem came to you in a dream this evening, for example, and offered you tomorrow as a freebie? Tomorrow you're off. I would say Sunday, but I'm from Eretz Yisrael, but I'm off on Sunday. No rewards, no punishments. No prohibitions, no restrictions. Eat what you'd like, taste what you'd like, take what you'd like, touch what you'd like, act as you'd like. What would you do? If you accept the Rambam's challenge, and you see yourself as the seed of Yitzchak, ki bi Yitzchak, your answer should be, I would not change one single iota. Get out to daven. Try to perform chesed to the best of the capacity, have an honest, ethical lifestyle, study God, explore His world, study His Torah, live an upstanding lifestyle, because it's right. Because it's the most redemptive experience known to man. But because I'll merit the next world. Does the Torah even mention Olam Haba? Is there ever a hint, a reference, a sign for the next world? You follow the mitzvot and the commandments, your elmal kosh, you'll live an abstinent, disciplined, profound, meaningful life of fulfillment, rather than a capricious and irresponsible life of indulgence. Yitzchak's unique capacity is to be stride two worlds. Maintain that firm and unwavering vision of the next world that's perfect. It cannot be shattered by the evil and the hardships of this world. But to embrace the world, to improve it, to excel at it. The Jew wavers between immanence and transcendence, between the present material world, between the future eternal world. And a brother-in-law, who, before he made Aliyah, was a rabbi in Miami, in actually southern Florida, in Boca Raton. And his responsibilities as a rabbi included traveling through the various hospital wards, and homes for the aged, and visiting some of the people who were natural members of the congregation, others who had just migrated to Florida. He told me the following story. Once was walking through the hallways, and he heard a man hallucinating in his bed, an elderly man. "My malachim, I'm coming. My malachim, I'm coming. I'm coming, my malachim." The brother-in-law was obviously quite interested in this man's tale. He waited a few moments for this man to become a little bit more lucid. He asked him, "What do you mean that you're coming to your malachim?" The man recounted the following story. He was a youngster who was also pulled out in Europe to a different Umschlagplatz, to a different gathering point, on the way to the concentration camps. And that day happened to be Erev Simchas Torah, Erev Shmini Atzeres. And he was tugging on his father's coat, Tati, Hakapos. "We're going to miss Hakapos, How can they be taking us somewhere?" You know the excitement the child feels for Hakapos. So the German SS guard, Yimach Shemo, wasn't enough for them to murder us, but to play with our minds, torture us before they killed us. He heard this little boy begging his father for Hakapos. He says, "You want Hakapos? Come." And he pulled him from his father, grabbed a few other youngsters and said, "Make Hakapos." Grabbed some people to play music. "Make Hakapos." The boy started dancing. The German guard pulled out his revolver and started to play Russian roulette with the children. One by one. The bullet marked finally, and he murdered one of their friends in cold blood. Both kids jumped back in horror. But the SS guard said, "Who told you to stop dancing? Keep dancing. You're one of the accomplices here, you're an accomplice." This monster forced them, these little kids, to dance over the slain body of their friends. One by one, these children are murdered as they continue to dance over the flowing blood of their friend. Finally, there are two kids left standing. And as they dance, this vicious game continues, and one of the children is killed. This final young child continues dancing. The SS agent turns to him and says, "Who are you dancing with? Your children, your friends have been killed. Who are you dancing with?" This little child looks up at the SS card and says, "I'm dancing with my malach." And he continues to dance. And the SS guard put his gun back in and just walked away. And every single year, this young man who grew into an older adult received a special hakafa in his shul. The entire shul would clear out the center, and he would have a lone hakafa. And it was known as the Malachim Tanz. And each year, he would dance with his malachim. And here he was, about to meet those malachim. Of course, we're not just the people of this world. Of course, we live, our courage draws itself from our vision, our keen sense of the next world, the God in heaven, Melech Malchim, Malchim HaKadosh Baruch Hu. We don't escape this world. We don't have to show a murder in this world. We certainly don't murder to get to the next world. The unique capacity of a Jew to bridge the two worlds, to unify the two experiences. Of course, we march through this world as a passageway, as a prosper, viewing the next world as a trochlin, as a palace. And of course, all of our efforts are invested in reaching that trochlin, in reaching that palace. But we do not ignore the prosdor. We do not ignore this world. We see it as a passageway which is intended, intended linked to the next world. It's one building, one bridge, one continuum, ki biritcha kikara l'chazara. Those are the three differences. How do we view our God? When we look up to heaven, we can't see God, but how do we abstract our God? Is a God of hate and murder, celebrates human suffering, a God of peace and harmony, desires the improvement of the human condition? Whose glory do we serve when we sanctify ourselves for God's name? Our own interests or the interests of a higher being? And finally, how do we view this dynamic? How do we view our experience, both in our current world and the world that Mirth Hashem will strive to achieve? Is it detached, a schizophrenic experience, or is it a continued process of spiritual self-development, drawing closer and closer to Kodesh Baruch Hu? Then we get to the next world, we're allowed to enjoy and to experience that level without the hindrances of our world. I guess I'm not taking any questions.
I think we are all speechless. Very powerful talk, but if you do have any questions, you can come up to the mic in a couple minutes. We'll take questions. But I want to thank Rabbi Derek, and it proves what I always say, that the finest of those of us who grew up in North America are living in Israel. That I find with all the speakers we bring in from Israel, there's a special quality that's a little bit hard to put my finger on it. But when you hear them speak, it's obvious that why they are living in Israel, the land of Kiddush Hashem, the land that Eina Hashem Alakech Abba, it's the land where God is looking upon us, the closeness to God, which is what Kiddush Hashem is all about, and that's the optimal way to do Kiddush Hashem. And those who are living in extremely difficult times, and Rabbi Peregrin is really in the heart of it, and Yisrael and Shalom, he's teaching Torah, which is our answer. And that is a high level of Kiddush Hashem. So I really want to thank him for bringing honor to our family, to the memory of our mother, and really, and like you say, it's a bracketed weekend. We start from, you know, sort of on the Saturn angle, and Yitz Hashem, in a couple of days, we'll be celebrating a Simcha. So I just want to thank him, and I know him a little bit as Maury's friend. When we were in YU, I'm 4 years older than Maury, so I was sort of the youngest smicha, whatever, and all his friends, they were at the beginning of YU, and I know who Maury's good friends are, and the good learners are, and the top guys, and of course, he's proving it. I don't know how many years he's been in the Rebbe in Gush now, but I see well, listen to him a little bit, the style of the dialectic a little bit. I can see the rubbing off. And thank you all for coming. Just before I we finish and have a little bit of refreshments, another act of Kirishim, you'll notice on your tables there are blue, these blue things on foster homes. Unfortunately, not every Jewish home is a Kiddush Hashem. There are many children in need at foster homes. It's one of the greatest mitzvahs, if anybody has the capacity and the will to help bring up a child in need to be a real parent. Kol HaMagadel, anybody who raises a child, is as if there's the parent of the child. So really, please take the blue folders. You or yourself know anybody. Unfortunately, there are many problems here everywhere, so take that in mind. The other thing, if you can, this is really, I hesitate almost to announce it, but the water sheets on the table, if you're not on the email list, if you don't get the weekly announcements by the time you're interested, so just, you can fill out the email. If you're on the list already, you don't have to fill that. If you don't want, don't, whatever, and I invite everybody to take a little bit of refreshments. We'll Doug and Marley, let's say, upstairs in 10 minutes or so. We'll make a meeting for Marley upstairs. Thank you very much.
I don't know if there
are
any questions.
All right, okay, we'll take one question. I said we'll take questions. I'm sorry, I feel bad now. I don't know. We'll take one question, then we'll have it privately. Dr. Goodman.
You stated that you can't achieve, say, murder conventions. We have mitzvahs like to eliminate and annihilate Hashemite. We call God, you know, the Kamas, God of vengeance. We demand God of vengeance. How is eliminating a Molech any different with a suicide?
The question is obviously a loaded one, but an important one. I'll wait you to sit down. In terms of the overall question, independent of tonight's year, how does a Jew explain genocide? How does a Jew explain children of Kiyom HaKamos? Well, Kiyom HaKamos Hashem, by and large, the role of God as vengeful is reserved for some eschatological endpoint of history where accounts are settled. Hashem Yukam Amo. By and large, even though HaKadosh Baruch Hu was referred to at certain points in history as the God of vengeance, the God, at least according to the Rambam, occupy a kind of his primary essence, primary being.
And the text must I?
I think those requests, again, I'll get to your second question about Amalek, because I think that's a little bit more of a tricky question. But in terms of defining a Kodesh Baruch Hu, by and large, all those requests are associated with the coming of redemption and the afterlife or the end of history, which clearly a reality will be, so to speak, balanced out against the injustices of history. The more than pressing question is about the divine perspective, how could God be vengeful, the human perspective, how could God command us to exterminate an entire people. The question itself I can't explain to you, and I'm not meant to explain to you. In other words, not just me, but anyway, part of our religion is also Gassakara, that as we try more and more to synchronize our own world with Hashem's Baruch Hu's will, to understand more of his Torah, to, so to speak, see the world through the lenses of Torah, there's a part of Torah that's supposed to be irrational and indecipherable. There are parts of our world that man can't solve. That's why Paraduma is the quintessential folk, because man doesn't have an answer to death. And when he comes into contact with death, the only way to achieve Tahara is through a folk. I'm not meant to explain HaKadosh Baruch Hu through a directly revealed commandment, which an entire people hears, not a hallucinatory dream, which I have one night on a personal level. But if then I see that I wish to shoulder to shoulder, we all learn HaKadosh Baruch Hu, then I'm meant to, so to speak, suppress my own will, suppress my own ration, and act based on HaKadosh Baruch Hu's command. Just as Avraham Avinu did at Har Moriah, there's a beautiful marriage that at Har Moriah, Avraham was crying. And initially we seem to flinch at this marriage. How could Avraham cry to fulfill HaKadosh Baruch Hu's will, the Hashem's will? The answer is, he cannot abdicate his human sentiments. The religion is not meant to strip him of his human sentiments. There is no reason to act against them. So that's in terms of a general response to how, at least I view, this mitzvah. In terms of the particular question, well, after all, having said that we can't rationalize it and understand it and decipher it, but isn't it the same, so to speak, as suicide bombers? I don't think that that mitzvah occupies a central role in our religion, in our experience, in our behavior. It's a mitzvah which we were given thousands of years ago, which we fulfilled to the best of our ability, and we were punished for not fulfilling it, shalom, as adequately as we could.
But it's not a binding mitzvah which spurs our religious behavior to which we turn to. It doesn't occupy the same pivotal position. The person is defined that our religion is successful based on piety, virtue, commitment, selflessness, etc. Whereas here, the highest heroes, the highest martyrs are defined by the ability to cast a shell and snuff out 40 lives and injure hundreds of others. So I'm obviously not answering your question, I'm not meant to, but the emphasis and the gravity which it occupies is very, very different.
Thank you.
Very good.
I think my son made a great show. I'll say she's back there, not to you, but
Moshe Bess of Heinz.
Oh, all right, that's good. How are you? Good. 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 Good.
Position and giving you an order. This must come out in print. He said it must come out in print. You have no choice. You're absolutely linear power. You have to come back. You didn't speak to a fraction of the number of people that you should be addressing, especially today. It must come out in print. Yes, you are. Marmot, Cohen, how are you talking about?